Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
Well, Sam, welcome to the era of Trump.
Yes.
Last weekend, everyone lived through a series of big events, starting with the inauguration of the nation's 45th president. The inauguration was not as filled as some Trump supporters would like, although the president says it was more populated than we think.
Yes, I believe that would be called a falsehood, but anyway.
And the weekend was followed by more controversy from his remarks at the CIA headquarters, where he seemed to focus in on this issue, to his press secretary coming out and blasting the press for not reporting about how many people were actually there. He, of course, gave his inauguration address, which was one of the darker addresses that we've heard in a while, talking about American carnage and promising jobs and security and sitting surrounded by Washington, saying that this whole city not only wasn't working, like Reagan said, but that they were directly and literally betraying people in this country. And while this is all going on, the confirmation process keeps moving forward. So far, despite a few fireworks, people are getting confirmed, and even Democrats, Senate Democrats, seem to be moving forward generally. So a lot's been happening and will continue to happen. So I thought that we could start discussing a little bit about where this is all going.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the post-inauguration world is that things are remarkably more like the Obama administration, which we can now refer to in the past tense, more like that than I was imagining, because I was imagining that maybe things would slow down, we'd get into, I don't know, the business of governing or what have you. But it seems like there's just a new news story every day. There's two tracks of news stories. One track is whatever antics the administration gets up to from the point of the press secretary, right?
Yep.
So Sean Spicer looking like his head's going to explode in his first appearance and saying things that are false, like the size of Trump's crowd at the inauguration. So that's one track. Meanwhile, there's this other track of actual governing, where cabinet nominees go up before Congress, come up for a vote, and as you indicated, they're still getting confirmed.
Right.
Right. And so there's those two tracks of confirmations where somebody like Rex Tillerson or whoever it might be is moving along through the process. Meanwhile, there's this show of Trump watching the news, hearing his crowds are not great, saying, presumably telling his press secretary to get out there. And so there's two shows in parallel. And it's fascinating to watch the campaign show, the Trump show, continue at the same time as what would normally happen, which is cabinet nominees going up.
What I can't figure out is how those are related, meaning part of me wonders if this is intentional. And so the strategy of the administration is to create chaos and to create a frenzy over issues. And this we saw in the campaign, while other very serious things are going on.
Yeah.
So you have a confirmation of very conservative people. You're issuing executive orders and starting to get the works for legislation. But then you get reporters to focus on the kind of craziest thing that you've just said. And the other stuff isn't really in the public purview. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but sometimes I wonder.
Right. The way it looks, at least to my eyes, is that I guess the question is whether the political laws of gravity are repealed or just suspended. And I think that from all appearances, Trump doesn't have a whole lot of self-control. He just says what pops into his head. He really is a one-man focus group of his part of the Republican Party, and he just sees these things, gets mad, fires off an instruction to his press secretary. So I would say that if we take at face value what it is that politicians do, he's just reacting with his characteristic amount of attention span and his characteristic emotional response. Now, that having been said, everybody else is still a creature of Washington.
Yeah.
Polarization was strong then. It's strong now. Republicans are doing what they usually do, which is to close ranks. Democrats do that too. But the Republicans are closing ranks and really, you know, holding firm on nominations. And so they seem to be moving ahead with the Republican president. And it seems as if what they're doing is saying, okay, this is who we get, and now we're going to roll with it. And if you're Mitch McConnell or you're Paul Ryan or you're Lamar Alexander, whoever you are, wanting to work to repeal the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, or whatever it is you want, Trump is part of the landscape that you have to work with. And so, you know what, if Trump says something inflammatory, I don't know, if I were a Republican leader, maybe I'd choose that as a great time to push something through.
Right.
Right? Because there's the Trump show,
yeah,
and everyone's watching to the Trump show, yeah, and not watching the actual substance.
Right. So you have you could imagine Speaker Ryan's pretty happy. I think there was that scene in the first day where he's signing the nominations, the papers for the nominations, and he's giving away the pens. And Ryan was just there with a big smile on his face. And, you know, you could imagine that part of him is feeling great right now because of that. On the one hand, he has everything he needs to move forward a lot of the agenda, not all of it, but a lot of it. And then you have this guy, the president, who is the total focus, rather than him or the Republicans, of what's going on in Washington.
So in that respect, then, it's a show where Trump puts on a show. It's just who he is. He doesn't have to be doing anything by plan. He just does what he does every day of his life. But in fact, what he is he's somebody with an R after his name who will sign off on Republican priorities. And so then the question turns into, I think at some level, he's currently very useful to Republican leadership in Congress.
Yeah.
How long is he going to be useful?
Yeah.
And so what kinds of things could happen that would make him not useful? And I'm just going to list two. One would be he decides not to sign ACA, Affordable Care Act repeal.
Right.
Right. He doesn't sign something. Another would be highly unlikely, but another would be not giving them a Supreme Court nominee that they like, which seems unlikely since he doesn't care about that topic, seemingly.
Yeah, I mean, the first executive order he put forward was on ACA, giving the agencies leeway.
But it was vague.
It's vague, but that's when you get suspicious. And since he's staffing the regulatory agencies with people, including Tom Price, who don't like it, that's the kind of leeway that a proponent would be nervous about.
Sure. Everybody's focused on Trump going off about crowds, using a CIA appearance to talk about his huge, giant crowds. Yeah. So people are focused on that. Meanwhile, the substantive event is Tom Price, who wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act, is getting his confirmation hearings for Secretary of Health and Human Services. And that is far less sexy, but that is the thing that is actually the substance of governing.
Yes. Yes. So that's how the two might work hand in hand. So I don't know. I don't know where this goes. And if I think we're going to continue to see this throughout his presidency in terms of what he can do. I don't know what I think the biggest thing he could do, obviously, is open up a corruption scandal that's significant. And all the makings for it are there, and whether you're talking about conflict of interest or whether you're talking about abuse of power. They're there, and that could cause a problem for the GOP. Well, but it would have to be pretty big.
Right. First, he's not selling his businesses.
Yeah.
Second, he is clearly inattentive to detail, and so he's not going to be really on top of all the details the way that, you know, the Obama administration seemed to be really notable for its lack of scandal. And so here now we have a president who is probably not paying attention to a lot of details because he's too busy watching ratings. And so, right, so one possibility is it's just going to take a scandal. Now, let me back up a little bit and bring up a thing that I think that we've been talking about a bit, which is Trump's approval ratings.
Yes.
Right.
Big issue.
Yeah. So before the inauguration, he was underwater. Fewer than 50% approved of him personally. And that was the lowest that any incoming president's ever had. Nobody's ever been underwater in terms of approve minus disapprove. Now the first job approval ratings are coming in. And, you know, they're more or less asking the same question because he hasn't done that much governing yet. But Gallup data typically shows incoming presidents with approve over disapprove of anywhere between 30 and 65 points. George W. Bush, 30 percentage plus, you know, approve over disapprove. John F. Kennedy, it's about 65% approve minus disapprove. And Trump is at 0%. His approve minus disapprove number is zero. Equal numbers of people, 45% each, approve or disapprove him. So he's 30 to 60 points below any incoming president since Eisenhower. And so he's starting in the toilet. And, you know, will he improve? Will he get better? Will he get worse? And one thing that I'm wondering about, getting back to the political laws of gravity, at what point does that matter? At what point does he become somebody who can't be president?
I don't know. Obviously, the default is to say this is a problem. And you compare him to George W. Bush after the 2000 election. And if you're doing worse than that,
30 points worse,
you'd imagine, boy, do you have a problem. And you don't have the stuff that you need for the so-called honeymoon period. That said, I'm not convinced this will harm him. meaning,
right.
A, I think the Republican Congress and the United Republican Congress gives him a lot of muscle to do things, regardless of what people think. And it will take a lot to get them to move away from this opportunity. B, there's part of me that watches Trump, and I've written about this. And, I mean, he wants to say he has great approval ratings, and he bashes you if you say he doesn't. But there's part of him who likes being the villain of politics. I think that is his character.
He's the wrestling heel.
Yeah, he's the wrestling heel, the anti-hero. Yeah. And he did it throughout the campaign. His approval ratings, you would know better. They were often, I think, always pretty bad.
He was always underwater in approval.
Right.
Right. Least popular presidential candidate in a long, you know, in the general election ever. And you're saying, you know, and also what was remarkable was that he's got this 30-40% of Republican voters who will stick with him.
Right.
They are his loyal base. He's their dude. That works out to about whatever it is, 1 out of 8 Americans. 1 out of 8 adult Americans loves him to pieces, and they will stick with him no matter what. And they're his dude, and he's their dude, and they're his people.
Right. So he has passion from his supporters, like you're saying, and it might be they don't like him personally. You hear this in interviews all the time. People say, I don't like him. I don't believe the things he says are right, but I'll support what he's doing. You know, if he has this window, like we're saying, to put some policies into place that attract more Republicans and even potentially cut out a few Democrats or obtain a little Democratic support, that could change where people are in terms of their feelings about him. And they never have to love him. And that might be enough to sustain himself. The key is, and we've talked about this in other episodes, including the Indivisible authors, that when do members of Congress feel that matters for themselves?
Right. So one question, I think, from the congressional standpoint is, when do they start thinking that they're at risk? Because if this turned into the threat of defeat, then they might turn. So, for example, I'll give I think that turning all of this popular energy from the protests that came after the inauguration, turning that energy into action is almost certainly going to require attention to swing districts where a district was won by 15 or fewer points. If a member of Congress won re-election by, let's say, 10 points or less, especially, then that person is at risk of being turned out of office. Mm-hmm. Now, with polarization and gerrymandering, that's not that many congressmen. But if we're going to see any kind of effect, it feels like that would be the place where it would get felt.
Yeah. But I think it's going to take a lot to reach the point where the party feels that they have some kind of risk, meaning the Republican Party as a whole.
Yeah. So one difficulty with that is that back in 2013, I think it was in 2013 that there were government shutdowns and the House Republican caucus was coming apart at the seams. And there was basically, it was the whole business with government shutdowns, right? And it was a replay of what happened in 1995. The generic congressional ballot preference, which is just the general question, which party do you think you're going to vote for Congress? That went through the floor it dropped by about, I don't know, about 9 or 10 points, which by polarized political standards, a 9 or 10 point drop is pretty large. And I had to be careful about that exact number. But anyway, but it was low enough that had the election been held that day, there's a fighting chance that Democrats would have retaken the House. But the election was not that day.
Yeah.
The election was over a year later. And in 2014, in fact, Republicans did quite well. And so there is this fact that even though things may look really bleak for any political party, it turns out that in the modern age, it turns out that a year and a half is a pretty long time. And one could imagine that, I don't know, maybe at some point Trump's low approvals will matter, but currently they have what in politics seems like a long time.
But the other part of it, I would say, is how the psychology of the president. So there are certain presidents who this bothers, and either practically someone like Lyndon Johnson was obsessed with what would this mean for my reelection bid? What would this mean for my congressional standing? Or what does this mean about me as a leader? But we're not dealing with – I don't think we're dealing with a person like that.
And it matters to him. It's just that it doesn't matter the way you just said in terms of practical nuts and bolts politics.
Right.
It still matters to him. It bothers him.
It bothers him. But I think there's part of him that plays that up. I think he likes hitting back. Yeah. And I think there's a confidence he has that I won. So in the end, that's really the biggest – point of of evidence for him. And look, he's governed in the first few days of his presidency. He didn't sit still. He was more like George W. Bush. He started governing. He is making moves away from the trade agreement. He does this with ACA.
He's governing as if he had a popular mandate.
As if he had a mandate. And he's saying he had a mandate. I mean, that's the other element of it, which is serious. And we don't know what's inside his mind. But he, in his mind, has a mandate. And the mandate that didn't exist is because of, you know, illegal voting and a rigged media, all those arguments.
Right. So let's see, the statement, like a recent statement that dumbfounded, I think, congressional leaders was the claim, which is false, that he actually won the popular vote and that 3 to 5 million votes were cast fraudulently.
Right.
Right, which is a false claim.
Which his press secretary then confirmed.
Yeah, yeah. So if he says these things, he gives every appearance of believing them. So I have a question that's a little inflammatory. Is he a pathological liar?
Well, that's a big question. Is he a narcissist? Is he a pathological liar? There are people who followed him who say that he is, that this is who he is. If some accounts, biographical accounts, say he's someone who traditionally says many things that aren't true. Some people see it as strategic. That's how he did his business. He'll say many things to get to what he wants. Others think he is someone comfortable with not telling the truth. I don't know which he is, but it's not unclear that he is willing to lie a lot and tell things to the public that are just not true.
But I think more, you know— I think hand in glove with that, he says these things. What that means is that the press is in a tough situation because the usual deal, I think, if I understand it, is that people rely on access journalism where they get access to official figures, to people who are in government, get information from those officials, and then, you know, they have to do other reporting. But one of the places where they start is what the official people in government say. And it feels like that might not be a good starting point if the press secretary is following what the president wants and telling verifiable falsehoods, then what?
I think the media is trying to figure this out. I have a more sympathetic view than some of the media, and I really think they're struggling. How do you deal with that, what you just said? But in general, just with this kind of presidential rhetoric, in the first, I think it was 2 days of the presidency, or 3 days, the New York Times had two headlines using the word. One, I think, said falsehood. One said lie.
Yes.
Which was – that was different than a lot of reporting you've seen for other presidents or for him. So I do think reporters are gearing up. When Kellyanne Conway made this statement early in the presidency, the opening weekend, about alternative facts to Chuck Todd.
Yes.
Quickly, I saw several reporters, including Todd's, there's no alternative facts.
Yeah.
That's just not true.
Yeah.
And
the alternative to a fact is a lie.
So it might be that the press is gearing up to take this on. The danger is, in my view, that you get sucked in back to where we started to the wrong debates. And at that time, the administration and the Republicans can do a lot of stuff while the reporters are distracted, maybe for the right reasons. But you get sucked into these things.
Yeah. So some people do seem to be amenable to some amount of popular criticism. I think that reporters, one question that I think that comes up for people who, who've been protesting these, this record high number of protesters, something like 3 million people who protested the day after the inauguration. One question for them is what to do after the protest is over. What can they do next? And one example of a demographic that might be swayed by them, by popular protest, might be, honestly, the press. And so I am under the distinct impression that reporters read their email and read their tweets or things that are tweeted at them. And so this is a group of people that seem to be pretty sensitive to criticisms of not holding Trump's feet to the fire and so on. And right now it's focused on Trump. And so I'm looking at a headline from January 23rd that says Trump – this is from the New York Times by Michael Shear and Emery – Hudeman. And I don't know whether they write their own headline at all, probably not. But anyway, Shear and Hudeman have a story that's entitled Trump Repeats Lie About Popular Vote in Meeting with Lawmakers. Mm-hmm. There it is. Trump repeats lie. And so I don't know. One could well imagine that somebody who wanted to be engaged in politics could write to Shear and Hudeman and say, thank you. Now, what about governing?
Yeah.
So great. So there's...
Well, the media, I mean, it's not insignificant. And the way that the media tells the story will matter. Politicians are not immune from media coverage, and neither is the administration.
Yeah.
And I think it can have an effect. And obviously what you expose, investigative journalism, has the potential to generate stories. You saw that with the Russian hacking story. And you could imagine policy-based work like that. I don't know if that's what will happen. And reporters don't want to put themselves in the position of purely being opponents of President Trump, because I don't think that's going to serve their purposes either. That will actually play right into his arguments. So you have to figure out how you do
this. Well, he is president of the United States.
He is president of the United States, right. But you can't have the Washington correspondents going out and simply writing hit pieces,
right?
Because that would play into exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, but this, again, gets, I think, to my thinking, it gets into the question of at what point does that leak over into other things?
Yeah.
At what point does it leak into difficulty getting policies through? Because look, if you're a member of Congress, what you want is you want to get your priorities through and you want to get reelected. Presumably, these are things that members of Congress want.
So in the short term, the low approval ratings that you wrote about historically don't necessarily stop him right now or stop the Republican Congress. I think we agree there's clearly a window where he can still do a lot. And in some ways, it's a little like Bush in 2001, where the controversy and the anger is not a check in the short term to govern. But the question is, does that change? And so one place it might change is the media. Does it affect how reporters look at him or willing to cover him? The other, does it affect the political opposition? I mean, I assume that was part of that weekend of protests that followed the inauguration.
I found that protest to be amazing. Mm-hmm. I was present at a protest in Oakland, and because I was traveling on the West Coast, and that was pretty far from Washington. And there was a tremendous outpouring of energy there. And all the reports are that what the crowd estimates are something like, if you add up all the crowds nationally, about 3 million people turned out for what's the largest mass protest in U.S. history. And then, did you get a feeling for what it was like?
Absolutely. I had an instant feeling, obviously, just watching social media. But I was in Washington on the Sunday after the protest, and I was coming back. I was there to do TV stuff, and I was coming back. And the train at, I forget what it was, 7 in the evening, was absolutely packed. And everyone was talking about the weekend, and they were talking about the protests and things they saw and signs they saw. They were talking about what comes next and what do you do to stop some of the legislation that's coming. And they were talking. I remember there was a kid, like a college kid, sitting with an older person, and they were both equally engaged in what are the next steps. And the only comparable moment I've had, it was also on a train. And it was back, I think, in 2009. I took a train to Washington, and I didn't know anything was going on that day. I was going to meet someone, and the train was packed, and everyone was talking about politics. And I said, boy, that's unusual.
Right.
And then we got to Union Station, and everyone got up, and everyone was carrying signs about Obama and about the new administration. It was the big Tea Party rally.
It was the Tea Party.
And I got out of Union Station, and it was an energy you felt. I remember, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be something.
But that's interesting, because at the time that the Tea Party was coming in, there were a lot of commentators, certainly liberal commentators, who thought that it was AstroTurf in the sense that it wasn't a real organization. It was just bankrolled by, donors, by people who are independent of the parties, like the Koch brothers or whatever. But at the same time, there was real energy in these people that you saw on the train. And that was in 2009, the Tea Party. These are real people who showed up. They're mad. They're going to Washington. As Ezra Levin and Angel Padilla said on our Indivisible podcast, they were yelling through the mail slots, spitting on them, and so on. These were angry people. And so you're saying that it was like that on the train, or not? Without,
I mean, the train is a small sample set, as you'd probably tell me.
Of course.
I'm the historian, so I could just see one thing.
Not a representative sample.
It's not a representative sample. But look, obviously the numbers that came out all over the country that weekend were a pretty significant
outpouring for protests. People who had never protested before.
Yeah.
People who were not usually engaged in politics.
Right. So there's something out there. But what the Tea Party did was they connected. Some of it was AstroTurf. AstroTurf.
As opposed to grassroots.
So you had Freedom Works, the conservative group, was funding. And that was clear. But what I think some people missed at the time was that those two would connect. The grassroots energy, the Washington organizations, the Republican Party, they came together by 2010, 11 into something bigger. And so the question now isn't, was there just a lot of energy over the weekend of protests that followed the inauguration. And it's not just what do you do next, the indivisible, but can the protesters connect with these institutional forces in democratic politics to make this something more sustained?
I've been interested in watching that. There are some signs of that. There's a project that I started at the Princeton Election Consortium of identifying swing districts near wherever you live. You type in your zip code, and it gives you a district that's close by. One of my readers set that up, and another one of my readers has founded this organization called Swing Left, and at swingleft.org, they have set it up so that you type in your address, it gives you a congressional district near you that was kind of close, and then it signs you up to get you involved in local activism in that swing district. And the idea is, it's the thing I was saying before, that the place where popular opinion turns into action is in swing districts. And they seem to have set up a pretty slick website. You know, they're a new organization, so there's some question about whether they're going to do anything with the email addresses or what they're going to do. But it's one of my readers, and he got his name is Ethan, and he got excited about it. He got excited about this little thing that we did on my website, and he said, you know, I think I could do that and harness it for my side. Honestly, it's symmetric in the sense that if you were a Republican, you could use the same website and look up swing districts, because swing districts are swing, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. But it so happens that this guy is a liberal, and he has started this swing left organization. And it's an example of, you know, possibly a step from popular protest to specific action.
Now, you want to throw cold water on that, in that if you go back to the Tea Party and you go back to the opposition that emerged, Democrats, and there's a new book about this by Jonathan Chait, he accomplished a lot, Obama, in a very short time frame. I mean, usually that's when presidents really only have a very small window to get most of their big bills through. So if what we said at the beginning of this conversation is true, there's still a lot of room for Trump and the Republicans in Congress to have a big impact on policy.
Yes.
Even before this stuff totally gels and that opposition starts to set in.
Well, he's the president. He's got majorities in Congress. He may be new to the game, but they've been around for a while, and they've had their wish list for a while. And whether the wish list is scaling back or eliminating climate change research, or doing away with alternative energy supports, or ending the Affordable Care Act, I don't know. They've got a list of things they've been wanting for a while.
Do you think, can I ask, you said if it's like physics, or laws of physics no longer apply, do you think that can happen? I'm curious what you think. Can a president who doesn't care about or governs regardless of his approval ratings and says things that are not true, whether he believes them or not, we don't know, but we know they're not true. Do you think a president has the capacity to change the political culture, meaning a couple years from now, the norms are different and expectations are different, and that could be part of the impact he has? What do you think?
Well, back in May, Andrew Sullivan wrote a column that I thought was, at the time I thought was kind of hysterical, but also made a point that has stuck with me, which is that the election of Donald Trump to the presidency for American democracy could be an extinction level event. Mm-hmm. And the idea that somehow a public official mostly telling the truth, no matter how much we complain about politicians telling lies, the culture is that they at least have to start with something that is in some way verifiably true. Mm-hmm. And that's been a tradition, right? That's just part of American democracy is having information be conveyed back and forth between citizens and between citizens and their government as part of what democracy is. And if that gets broken, that's a thing that is not enshrined in the Constitution, that's not in the law, but it's part of who we are as a society. Now, could that norm break? That would be a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Look, presidents lie. I think that's important to remember. And there was a great book years ago by Eric Alterman, and I think it was called When Presidents Lie. He writes for The Nation. And it was a history of all the fabrications you've seen, whether to cover up, you know, military operations that are taking place by the CIA or weapons of mass destruction, obviously, one of the big lies that we've had, to smaller lies. I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Yeah. You see that, but this does feel different in that there is no pretense of being subtle, no pretense of doing this selectively on key political issues. It's a norm of just saying whatever is in your mind, regardless of
it's like
true or not.
It's like our colleague Harry Frankfurt and his book On BS.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want my kids to be able to listen to the show, so I'll just say it like that, On BS.
Yeah.
Where just saying false things without regard for the truth, without caring whether they're true, right? That's the core quality of BS. And if you look at a source like PolitiFact, typical politicians at a national level tell the truth more often than they lie, and the ratio of true statements to false statements is anywhere from 3-1 to 6-1. So in fact, actually, Hillary Clinton scores pretty high in that domain. But with Trump, it's actually the other way. It's actually, in fact, the majority of what he says are demonstrably false. And that is an amazing track record, to just lie to such an extent that it's just a constant stream, right? Mm-hmm. Chaff, like just glittery objects that are so confusing to cover that there are too many things to cover. Then what? Yeah. What happens to society? What happens to our federal government? Now, the federal government is composed of thousands of officials. I think that these lower level officials are almost certainly to some extent bound by some of these laws of gravity. And so presumably they can't do it. Who was it who had to withdraw as a nominee? The woman who's going to be a speechwriter, I think, for the NSA.
No, Crowley.
Crowley, right?
Yes.
Like,
because of plagiarism.
Because of plagiarism.
Yes.
I mean, in fairness, she was going to be a speechwriter, so it's not a great move. So it's a bad quality in a speechwriter to be a plagiarist. But nonetheless, that's an example of a political law of gravity that is still in effect. And so,
he could change it, though. It's that's kind of the story of the campaign. Everyone kept saying, I don't think people realized how the politics had changed, not just because of him, but all the things we keep talking about, conservative media and other factors. And then at a certain point, everyone wakes up and says, this is not the world we used to have. And so as president, he has a big influence on people. And has that capacity to change norms. Not totally. Presidential power, I always think, is overrated, and there's limits to what you can do, including with the bully pulpit. But I do think this can have a qualitative impact. And it's not just him. Look, on the debates about climate change, regardless of him, we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years how there's this attack on science and the truth, and it's gained hold in the public culture. So there's reasons beyond Trump why these trends can continue.
Well, there's a general difficulty in what's the role of knowledge, what's the role of factual information. On the right, there's a writer, Tom Nichols, who's written about this. On the left, Chris Hayes has written about this. And so there are people who've written pretty compellingly about the decline in the role of knowledge in society. And so that's been something that's been going
on for
decades.
That's what this is a part of, right.
Yeah. And so Trump personifies that, and there is
and
a question.
Can amplify it.
Yes, and so now that somebody like that is in charge, now what does that mean? And so that creates a special burden, I think, on anybody who wants to stop that to get in the way of it.
That's where he's a culmination of trends, not just the cause of trends. I think that's a key issue with him that people want to know. We're almost out of time, but let me ask you one question that I'm sure people are curious about. Have you been following what's going on with polling now? Post-election, are people making changes, or how they feeling about the polling now that the dust has settled a little bit?
I've been following it a little bit. I will say that I'm a little bit saturated on the question of polling, so I myself have been avoiding it somewhat. I think there's a lot of self-examination. I think there's an attempt to think about new polling methods, to come up with new ways of sampling voters, new ways to assess opinion that might not involve asking opinion directly. So it might involve indirect methods like using social media and web search and other ways of monitoring opinion. Honestly, it's sort of hard to think this way, but the polling error in this last election was only about 4 points. And so it's a relatively small error in some ways.
Yeah.
So it feels like if pollsters can do things like address how they deal with undecided voters, that would probably be a big step forward. I think that pollsters are right now still licking their wounds and working on it. But my general sense is that the error is not as large as to be a crisis event for them. At some level, the question for them is probably one more of credibility, where people believe that they laid a giant egg. And so the question is what to do about that.
I think it's going to be relevant to what we're talking about, because in terms of gauging what people think of the administration and the moves that they are making, the soundness of polls after an event where fairly or unfairly they've come into question matters. And it's going to matter that people say, look, people don't like this move on Obamacare, or if you're a Trump supporter, they love what he just is doing with so-and-so. That will matter. And the second part is, in this era where it's hard to discern fact from fiction. Yeah. There are claims about all sorts of things. Polling, in some ways, it becomes triply important that we have some measures that we can take.
So I think one way, I mean, my own nerdy way of dealing with that is just to say, look, the error was 4 points. People who make predictions and reporters and pundits took those 4 points and amplified them into a certain win for Hillary Clinton, and they were wrong. We were wrong. But if you look at the approval numbers, that's a 4-point error. But if you look at the numbers, it's a 40-point deficit that Trump has compared with past presidents in approval. So a 40-point deficit is 10 times as large as the error. And so I think one way to think about this is to just remind people that a 4-point error does not invalidate a 40% approval deficit.
So when you see those approval ratings that you wrote about, and he, President Trump, or his supporters say, well, the polls were wrong in the elections, and so this stuff is irrelevant.
No, but the polls were right during the primaries. The polls said that Trump was going to get the nomination, and he did.
Yeah.
The polls said that Hillary Clinton was going to win the popular vote by a couple of percentage points, and she did. The polls said that Hillary Clinton was likely to win the Electoral College, but it would be close. And if we being the data nerds, if we had been paying attention more closely, we would have been more skeptical and said, well, you know, it's going to be pretty close.
Yes.
And it was the fault of the people analyzing the data that we said, you know, it's close, but Hillary's ahead. And in the back of our minds was almost certainly something like, and how could Trump possibly win? And so I think it's contingent on anybody who analyzes data to look at the data and not carried away by that little voice that says, how could he possibly win? Because he won.
And so we are dealing with a president who has historically low approval ratings, and we can be confident in knowing that. We don't know what it means or what the implications are, but those are strong, solid, and uncontroversial
numbers. He might get his policies, but he's definitely not popular right now.
Okay, on that note, we will end. That wraps up the episode. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.